and self-duality, and self-self-duality. And then we're going to finally get to the Blavatsky, there's a bunch of names, Blavatsky, Ashtakar, formalism, etc., which are the action principles which give rise to, which were basically the beginning of the classical version of loop quantum gravity, if you like, if close. And then, so that we're up to date, since this stuff is like 1988 or something, we're going to talk about the Laurent Artem formalism, which is the most exciting thing that's happened in terms of classical formulation of general relativity in the last few years. And that, because I'll forget to say it when I get to it, is ATP EH0501191. And everything else is in the same review paper I've been using, which is 0209079. Okay? Great. Any questions? That's our agenda. Okay. So, with Palatini, and so the basic idea is we have a four-term manifold. It's going to be some three-manifold cross time. And on it, we have fields. We have a connection or a gauge field. Omega. A, remind me what indices I've been using. I've been using mu nu for internal Lorentz indices. So these are one forms. So when I want to indicate that, there's a one form index down here. And these are live in the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. And I'm going to do SO4. I'm going to do everything today in Euclidean unless I say so otherwise. Doing everything in Euclidean signature. Okay. So what that means is there are frame fields, E, A, and U. And that is labeled 0, 1, 2, and 3. This tells you these are one forms. And even I'm going to use the same notation, even though it's a little bit non-standard. So the metric is 1, 1, 1, 1. Except when we go to Lorentzian, it's going to be. So this is Euclidean, and this is Lorentzian. And I remind you that the metric GAD is EA mu, EB nu, eta mu nu in all signatures. Okay? So this is the setup. We have frame fields from which we make the metric. These specify a Cartan moving frame, as he was called it. They correspond to an orthonormal frame, which is what this means. So the inverse of this is the GAB, EAMU, EB nu, is a mu nu, which tells us that these one forms make an orthonormal frame at each point. And this is preserved by an SO4 local symmetry that takes EA mu to EA prime mu, sorry, mu is some Lorentz transformation mu nu of EA nu. So these are Lorentz, which means they live in SO4. And I apologize for mixing up Lorentz, Euclidean, etc. That's become so common in the field that I'm just going to make the standard mistakes that everybody makes so you get used to them. So when I say a Lorentz transformation, if I'm in Euclidean signature, I mean that we're treating time and space equally, so I mean really an SO4 transformation in the four-dimensional rotation group, and if when Lorentzian, I mean SO3-1. But I'll just use Lorentz to indicate a rotation of the frames.
Is that in both spaces, internal and external?
This is all internal.
Just
internal. Okay. I've just been, you came here rather than the dinner?
Yeah,
at least. You don't even know what they're serving?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so the space-time indices are these abstract indices in which these really are just positions. They're telling you you're dealing with one forms. And this is a metric with two low indices. Okay? Okay. And then we have the, so I don't remember what notation I used, but I think I used FAB. Mu nu, let me not write that to begin with, is the alternatively the field strength. Let me just say the field strength is dA mu nu plus A mu lambda wedge A lambda nu. There are several different ways to write that. And so this is the SO4 field strength. And you could regard it just as an object in a Yang-Mills-like theory in which there is a Yang-Mills field strain for this internal SO4 symmetry. And everything goes through in the previous lecture. We talked about Yang-Mills theory and the general equations for the gauge, for how the gauge symmetry, the gauge field transforms and how the field transforms, field strain transforms. You can also regard this as the space-time curvature. And the strength of everything we're doing is this double point of view in which the, oh, no wonder everybody's looking confused. Everybody has the right to look confused because I screwed up. I was calling these things omegas. Thank you for being too polite to mention that. Okay. Which the omegas are gauge fields, and you can think of them just as gauge fields with the gauge group of SO4, but you can also think of them as connection coefficients for the curvature of space-time. And that double thing is what makes these kind of the results that I'm going to be showing you in the quantum theory possible. Okay. So any questions about this? This is all the setup. Then we make an action, and the action we call the Palatini action is a four form, so it's an integral over the four manifold of some four form, and we just write down some of the four forms that we can write down. The first one is we take two E's and an F. And there are two ways, one, as I said last time, you can tie these up. Since this is odd because of the wedges, if I just hold these indices fixed, the frame indices fix, and I make a parity transformation in which I take the space-time coordinates to minus themselves, then this changes sign. So this is odd under parity. Since general relativity is parity symmetric, I'd like to have an action which is even under parity. So to do that, I make another odd combination of these indices, which is I use the anti-symmetric symbol to tie it up like this. And I'm going to write these things in several forms. So if I make explicit the wedge, that means there's an epsilon A, B, C, D tying up these indices, and it goes, and so it's really two epsilons, epsilon mu nu lambda sigma, times E A mu, E B mu, F C D lambda sigma. And so these two epsilons make this together even. And notice that the two epsilons are different. This acts on the internal space. These are the internal, or the indices in the local orthonormal frame. This is on the manifold. This is, I think it's called the Levitch, this has a name, Levitch-Vida. Okay. And this thing is a density, transforms like a density under coordinate transformations. And this is not.
I think it's called the anti-symmetric tensor. Let's see the anti-symmetric.
Yeah. Although it's really a density, because it has the values either 1, 0, or minus 1 in every coordinate system.
So you don't put the square root of minus g.
So there's no square root of minus g. That's very important. This is polynomial. There's no square root of minus g. It's just exactly what there is here. Okay? So that's the first term.
So there are also the second epsilon? I mean, if you have also the parity in the internal space, then it's also density because of the.
Well, this is
proof, right?
This is not a density because this just transforms under local Lorentz transformations. The only transformations we allow acting on these indices are local SL4 transformations.
Yes, we don't allow parities in that space.
Oh, you're worried about I when you're changing sign.
Yeah, I mean, that's also possible.
Yes, no. What I mean when I say is if I take the frame fields to minus themselves, then the E's change sign. Okay. And if I take the space-time coordinates or the orientation of the space-time manifold to minus itself, this changes sign. Mm-hmm. Under both things together, it's even.
The whole thing, yeah.
The whole thing's even.
No, I was just thinking about that symbol that it's a tensor under restricted when you only have things connected to the identity.
Yes.
But if you allow more, then it has to be
but what you're saying is that there is, if I consider the group that preserves the metric, so I consider transformations of the form of G, the metric G inverse is equal to the metric,
yeah,
without writing the indices, then this in general is O4, and that includes the parts connected to the identity, which are the continuous transformations, and discrete transformations, like parity and the inversion, just t to minus t or z to minus z. So this is invariant under the whole actual orthogonal group. If when you make a parity transformation that is an odd transformation, internally you also reflect the orientation of the manifold to minus itself.
I
think I understand what you're saying, and I'm going to ignore that. Okay. In fact, I'm going to come to a term which will illuminate that. There are several other terms we can write. I'm going to write just one more term. So I'm going to stick this epsilon mu nu lambda sigma at the end here. Another term you can write is a term with four E's. So it is a term which is E mu wedge, E nu wedge, E lambda wedge, E sigma, with some coefficient which is usually written minus 2 lambda. And similarly, this is minus 2 lambda E A nu, E B nu, E C lambda, E B sigma. So this is the same as that. And this term gives me the determinant of E, which by the relationship between E and the metric is the square root of the determinant of the metric all by itself. Okay, so this is the cosmological constant term. And then there are other terms with two R's, and I'm not going to discuss those at this moment. We can come back to discuss them. Okay. So this is the Palatini action. And I showed last time that the field equations are the Einstein equations. Okay. And I, unless somebody wants me to, I'm not going to go through that again. I'm going to take this as the starting point. Okay? But I will write them. So delta S, no, I won't need them today, and I wrote them last time. So it will not bother you. Okay. Now, this is well and good, but there's this beautiful structure that happens because of duality and self-duality. And I mentioned it, I think, at the end of last time, and let me state it again and then start drawing consequences from it. And the idea is, let me just state it again, so given any anti-symmetric tensor, and I'm just going to work in the frame field indices, so T mu nu is minus T nu mu, right? And all that I need, I'm working really in the tangent space, so all I really need is that I'm in four dimensions. Okay. Then there is an operation called taking the dual, where you take T, you take the dual, and its mu nu index is epsilon mu nu alpha beta T alpha beta times 1/2. Because there's a double sum since these are anti-symmetric. And here I've lowered the indices with the metric. So in the case that the metric is Lorentzian and there's some minus signs snuck into here. Okay? So one way to say this is that T01 dual is equal to T23 and cyclic. Now, a property of this is that dual is equal to plus 1 for the Euclidean case, and if you put the signs in, minus 1 for the Lorentzian case, if you do it twice. And you notice that this is a special thing. It's only in four dimensions where you can do this to two-dimensional tensors. These two-dimensional tensors, by taking commutators, generate a Lie algebra. So you get a special feature of Lie algebras having to do with four dimensions, which we're going to draw out in a moment. Okay. Now, give the next structure is that given T, you can take T plus or minus mu nu, which is a half T plus or minus T dual. Everybody has in common the indices mu nu. And so what this is, for example, is that T plus or minus 0, 1 is a half T 0, 1 plus or minus T 2, 3 and cyclic. So what we're doing is, if you sort of remember how the FAD works for the electromagnetic tensor, there's sort of E1, E2, E3, 0, B3, how does it work? This is the 1, 2, 3, 1, 3, minus B2, B1, 0, 0, and anti-symmetric. So this is how we fit the electric and the magnetic fields into the field strain. And so a way of saying this is that F01 is E, and actually I made a mistake. We actually don't want those one halves. Sorry. Is E, F01 plus minus is E plus or minus B, basically. One. So these put together the electric and magnetic fields in adding them together or subtracting them. And basically, the way you can think of it physically is, rather than writing two three-dimensional vectors, the E fields and the B fields, we pair them up differently and we write the E plus B fields and the E minus B fields. And this is interesting and useful because there are interesting cases in which we want to say the electric field is equal to the magnetic field, or the electric field is minus the magnetic field. Now, under this operation of dual, there are three of the T pluses and three of the T minuses, and they're eigenvectors of them. So under dual, T plus or minus mu nu dual is plus or minus T mu nu plus or minus, which you can check. Okay. Any questions? Okay, now, in terms of the Lie algebra of SO4, we can think of the Lie algebra of SO4 as given by these anti-symmetric matrices, which are trace-free. Because if I have, let's say, 2, T1, and T2, and I take their commutator, I get somebody else who's anti-symmetric and trace-free. So the anti-symmetric, sorry, I'm being dumb, trace free is, what happens when I don't need you for class? Trace free is for free, right? It's anti-symmetric. So the six linearly independent anti-symmetric 4x4 matrices make a six-dimensional space, which is the Lie algebra of SO4, and it closes under commutators. Now, a thing you can check is that if you take the plus ones, commutated with the plus ones, you end up in the plus ones. So they close. And they make a three-dimensional space because there's three independent. We're taking the six guys in the anti-symmetric matrices and we split them into the plus ones and the minus ones, which are each three independent ones. And the plus ones close by themselves, the minus ones close by themselves, and the plus ones all commute with the minus ones. So what we've done is taken this six-dimensional space and split it up into two three-dimensional spaces. that commute with each other. And this six-dimensional space is the Lie algebra of SO4, and each of these three-dimensional spaces, if you check explicitly, and I'll show you how to do that in a minute, give you SO3 plus SO3, or equivalently SU2, as far as the Lie algebra is concerned, plus SU2.
So if this is Lorentzian,
if this is Lorentzian, there are minus signs and I's everywhere. Yeah, do you want me to show you now where? Or let me just indicate. Do I have a color chart? So I can save my, because I'm sure we might get excited and forget to say it later. Okay, so the blue is Lorentzian. So you have to put an I there, you get a minus sign there, you get an I here. And that's all. You get an I there. Okay? So it's quite a substantial difference. The new thing that you get is that T plus mu nu is equal to T minus mu nu complex conjugate, which is a structure you don't have in the real one. So in the real one, because there's an important difference. In the real one, you start with a six real dimensional space, and you get two real three dimensional spaces, which are independent. E plus B is independent of E minus B. In the Lorentzian case, you start with a real six-dimensional space, and you get two complex three-dimensional vectors, which, however, are complex conjugates of each other. So giving one is the same as giving the other, so you still have six real degrees of freedom.
So you can't split it.
This is still true.
That's still true.
It's still true.
So you can't split into.
Yes. Okay. And it's still true, in fact, that SO3(1) splits into SU2 into two SU2s. Okay. But this SU2, these have names. We call this SU2 left and SU2 right. And what happens is that E plus IB rotates under this SU2 left, not E plus B. And E minus IB rotates under this SU2 right. And it's very explicit that you can really check that E plus, if you want to transform E plus IB, it is a singlet under this, and it just rotates under this. And E minus IB is a singlet under this and just rotates like a vector under this. Okay, so, and the differences between the real and the Lorentzian case, the Euclidean and Lorentzian case, are important. Okay, and these are facts of the world of Lie algebras, that the Lie algebra, let me just show you how you would say this. Oh no, I screwed my definite rule. Okay. I think I can put that part way up there. So let me just review the Lie algebra of SO4 or SO3(1). Okay. There are the rotations Ji, which I can think of as Ji is epsilon ijk tjk. And these three j's have an algebra of ji, jj is epsilon ijk jk. There are boosts, and this generates SO3. And I will not keep saying that SO3 is locally the same as SU2. There are boosts say, I'll call them, that's not what they use. What are they usually called, Bruce?
K.
K. Thank you. K. And K satisfies, first of all, that they're a vector under the spatial rotations. So this is like minus epsilon, don't trust me for the sign, K, K. So these rotate like a vector. And the boosts close in the rotations. So two boosts, Ki, Kj, close epsilon I, J, K in the rotations J, K. And that's the Lie algebra of SL4 with appropriate signs of SL3, 1. Now what we've done is invented some guys called J plus or minus I. And these guys, the K's, are like the T0i's, components of the general anti-symmetric four-dimensional matrix. They're like a basis for the T0i's. So the J plus or minus are like Ji plus or minus Ki. And you can show that they close nicely, J plus I, J plus J, is epsilon ijk j plus k, and the same thing for the minuses. And the j pluses and the j minuses commute with each other. So this shows explicitly that inside the SO4, there are two SO3s that commute with each other. Now, moreover, under parity, the J pluses go to the J minuses. So under parity, which is reversal of all the coordinates, J plus mixes up with J minus. So that's why we have a right to call them left and right-handed, because they go into each other under parity reflection. Okay, so this is how to see what's happening at the level of the group theory. Now, there's, since I promised you the I's are here in the case of the Lorentzian case. Okay, so then, if you like, one of the SU2 left is making a rotation around an axis and boosting in that direction at the same time, possibly with an I, and the other one is doing the opposite with the other sign. Okay, and that's what's going, that's what these two things are. Okay?
So then you really have to complexify at least more.
In the Lorentzian case, sure.
In the Lorentzian case, would there be an I in front of the epsilon or the quantity?
Yeah. Here?
No, but the Lorentzian case. No, just right there, in the middle.
Here?
I mean, the I problem epsilon in the Lorentzian case.
These are not in the two-dimensional, these are not, these, what I'm thinking of is that these guys come from 4x4 matrices. They're particular, they're actually, so if I continue with that speech, I'm going to confuse this. There are different representations. And I can represent those guys as commission or anti-commission generators, according to which there's an I here or not. And I'm choosing to represent them as anti-commission generators, in which case I hope I have it right that there's no I here. Because if they're power matrices which are commission, there is an I here, right? Yeah. So if they're anti-commission, there's no I. Okay. Okay? So, this is all just group theory, and there's a lot of interesting stuff hidden in there. And when we come to express things in terms of spinners, which we're not going to do today, there are very elegant ways to express all of this in terms of the spinner language. But we're not, one thing at a time, and one notation at a time. Okay. Now, the discovery that underlies the sort of dynamics of loop quantum gravity is that the Einstein equations and the actions simplify when we take these decompositions seriously. So what we do is we start with the connections omega mu nu, and we take their plus or minus form. So we take plus or minus, and I'm doing the Euclidean case today, omega plus or minus dual, and those are called A plus or minus. And by a kind of abusive notation, since there are only three of these that are really independent, we take the A, that is A23 is related to A01, plus or minus, plus or minus. I'm going to use spatial indices. AI is A0I. I is equal to 1, 2, 3. And I try to be consistent always and use spatial indices 1, 2, and 3 for I. So we have these guys AI. In other words, these are seen now as labeling generators of SU2, either SU2 left or SU2 right. Okay? And sometimes I'll write it like this, and sometimes I'll write it like this. But in other words, we're taking the six connection coefficients omega of the Lorentz group, and we're dividing them up into the three of SU2 left and the three of SU2 right explicitly. In the Euclidean case, they're real and independent, and that's the case I'm dealing with now. Now, the F, interestingly enough, F splits, big theorem, F splits into F plus mu nu and F minus mu nu. Okay, let me prove that. F plus is a half F plus F dual. And F minus is a half F minus F dual. So F is F plus plus F minus. Okay? That part is trivial. What's not so trivial is that F plus mu nu is a function just of A plus. It's dA plus mu nu plus just A plus, if you like, commutator. Well, that would be too confusing. I won't write it that way. I'll write it in this way, A plus lambda nu. And another way to write this is F plus I, taking the 0, 1, the 0 I part and calling it I, is equal to dAi plus, if you work it out, a half epsilon ijk aj wedge ak. That is, it looks just like an SU2 gauge theory, an SU2 gauge field. So this is the trivial theorem that F splits into F plus and F minus, and slightly less trivial is that F plus only depends on A plus. So this is the curvature, or the field strength, in the plus, or we say self-dual. Plus is often said to be self-dual, because it's an eigen function of the dual operator. And it's a function only of the self-dual part of the connection. Okay? And this happens, there's no cross term with A plus with A minus, because the two generators commute, because the SO4 has fallen into an SU2 left and an SU2 right that commute with each other. And I think it was probably Klebanski who was the first person who understood that you could go to town with this. And let me just indicate how he went to town. He considered then there's also sigma mu nu. which is E mu wedge E nu, I'm taking the frame fields and I'm making an object which is a two-form, which is anti-symmetric because the wedge is an anti-symmetric product of mu and nu. So it's equal to minus sigma nu mu. And this two-form has in it the information about the E's. And then you could, of course, consider that sigma is sigma plus plus sigma minus doing the same trick. Split it up into its self-dual piece and its anti-self-dual piece. Okay? And now, note now, something cool happens because the Plobansky action. Let me just deal with the first piece, with the cosmological concept. Plobansky action is sigma mu nu wedge F dual mu nu. Because the epsilon, where is my Plobansky action gone to? The epsilon here just takes the dual. And E wedge E is the sigma. So this is sigma wedge F dual. Okay? And that is sigma wedge F plus dual plus sigma wedge F minus dual. But F minus, F plus dual is F plus, and F minus dual is minus F minus. What's that? But this is the plus part. So there's a 1 plus dual sitting in here. So that transfers over to here. In other words, if you write, this is sigma plus sigma minus wedge F plus. But the part which is sigma minus with F plus is 0. Because they commute with each other. They're in disjoint parts of the algebra. So, this is just the integral of sigma plus mu nu wedge F plus mu nu minus sigma minus mu nu wedge F minus mu nu. And this is really a function of E, and this is really a function of omega plus. This is really a function of E, it's a different function, and this is a function of omega minus. So in the action, they split. Okay, and we'll come back to what happens to this term in a minute. Okay? Now, some cool person came around. And I think that the first such cool person was Plobansky, but nobody I knew of the paper or understood it, even when we were shown the paper, okay, who said, well, that's cool. So this was S. Palatini. Okay. And basically what Plobansky said is, why not just throw away half? So Plobansky said, consider the action which is sigma plus, the function of the E's, wedge F plus, which is a function of the A plus. Period. So let me write out what that is. That's E, and there are many ways to write it, E mu wedge E nu plus part wedge F plus E nu. which is a function of A plus. There are many ways to write it, and you don't actually have to write the plus part here. Because, if you like, there's a projection operator in this trace over the mu indices. There's a projection operator, let me just write it out, p plus or minus is an operator which takes anti-symmetric pairs of indices to anti-symmetric pairs of indices. And if the projection operator is 1 plus or minus the dual, where this 1 is delta mu lambda, delta mu sigma, anti-symmetrized. And you can prove that p plus squared is p plus, and the same for minus, and p plus, p minus is 0. It's another way to say what I've been saying. So there's, once you have a plus, there's a projection operator sitting there, and you don't have to write it explicitly anywhere else. So Plobansky said, and we've got people who didn't know about Plobansky later said, consider that as an action.
Sorry, what was the motivation?
It was the justification. I'll tell you what the motivation was. Let's look at the field equations. I mean, when we did it later, we knew what we were looking for. Since I could never read, maybe now I could read Plobansky's paper, but so I have no idea what his motive is. It's something to do with twister theory, because all of this is actually closely related to twister theory. Let's look at the equation of motion. The equation of motion for E, delta E A mu, looks a lot like the Einstein equations. There's epsilon A B C D E B mu, that's the same, and here we have F C D plus mu nu, like that. Is equal to 0. Okay. And notice what that is. That's the same thing as the regular Einstein equations, which just have FCD mu nu, the regular Einstein equations. So since this is a plus, I can put the epsilon back for free. So if I want to, I can have sigma rho epsilon mu nu sigma rho. I can get that for free because this is F plus. Okay, so I can put the sigma back, the taking dual, because that's just a plus sign on F plus. Okay? So then I have F C D sigma rho plus the dual sigma rho C D epsilon mu nu sigma rho. Okay. If I just had this, it would be the Einstein equations. But I have this extra term with the dual in it. Okay? What do the other equations say? The other equations are where we vary by omega plus. I'm sorry, A plus. Now, recall when we vary by A, by all of omega, when we vary by all of omega, we got an equation that said the covariant derivative of E wedge E is equal to 0. And we solved that, actually I left it as an exercise, but my guess is nobody did it, but I hope you did it, and it would be good for your soul if you did it, that if you ran that through, you would find out that omega is equal to omega, which is a function of E and its derivatives, which is the Christoffel symbol. Okay? Now what you get is, from taking the derivative of A plus, is a covariant derivative in just the SU2 plus, the SU2 left part of E wedge E plus is equal to 0. And if you work that through in bigger detail, you get, believe it or not, that A plus is equal to the plus part of omega, which is a function of E. Okay? Now, when I put this in, then that implies that I have 0 is equal to this stuff, which is the Einstein equations. So let me write it out. Epsilon A, B, C, D, E, B, mu, F, C, B, sigma, rho, plus, I'll get around to that in a minute, E, mu, sigma, rho, plus, where this is now a function of derivatives of the metric here, and this is now the dual of F, which is a function of the derivatives of the metric. But if you work through what this second term actually is, now that it's all a function of derivatives of the metric, and so you have the Gestapo symbol sitting in there, if you work out what it is, it's R, A, B, C, D, totally anti-symmetrized on three indices. And that's 0 by the Bianchi identities. So the second term is 0 when you use the equations of motion for the omega. Now, I'm doing this quick. To do all the steps of this is the whole 3 hours to get it right, okay? Especially this little bit here. Okay? This is something that's really worth checking and going through. That you really do get exactly the right equations, the right number of equations, the right equations. This tells you that A plus is the self-dual part of the Gestapo connection. But when you put that back in, this term is the trace of the dual on two of the indices of the Riemann tensor of the Gestapo connection, and that's the same thing as this, and in other words, with the B, with this trace there, and that's 0. Well, you don't need to the last trace to do that.
This one?
This is, well, it has
cyclic
some, what?
Cyclic.
The cyclic whatever identity. Okay, some identity. Okay, named after some person called cyclic, I don't know. Anyway, okay. This is very cool. Because what it means is that you only need half the information in the action to get the Einstein equations. Okay, and this is a big check. If you haven't checked anything else in this class, this is a big check. And
if you start with the other part, you still get the same
thing. If you start with the other part, you still get the same thing. Yes. Yeah.
So this is because all the three domains and some of the equations are just
right. So it turns out that in the Palatini action, you're getting the Einstein equations twice. It's redundant. No wonder it's hard to quantize if you have the field equations twice from the same action principle. Okay. And it turns out that twice, there's the equation, if you like, is twice too strong. And so you should only take half the action.
It doesn't have twice as many degrees of freedom.
It does not have twice as many degrees of freedom.
So?
Yes.
I mean, it's not that it ends.
In the real case, that's right. And I was being a little bit loose. In the complex case, we'll talk about it later. Because the complex case is subtle. On that exactly that issue. Okay. I should just fill in what happens to the other term, and let me just say that not surprisingly, okay, E wedge, E wedge, E wedge, E, mu, nu, lambda, sigma, epsilon, mu, nu, lambda, sigma, becomes sigma plus mu, nu, wedge, sigma plus mu, nu, minus, if I remember right, sigma minus mu, nu, wedge, sigma minus mu, nu. It couldn't be anything else because sigma plus traced against sigma minus is zero. So even if you put in the term with the cosmological constant, minus 2 lambda, that splits as well into a part which is sigma plus wedge sigma plus, and the sign comes along the right way. Sigma minus wedge sigma minus. So even with the cosmological constant, it splits into two pieces. Okay? Any questions? Okay, now, we're just getting started. Okay. This is not it yet, although this is pretty cool. Okay, this is not it. If you wanted to, you could start with the action here and do some fun things with it. But we're just getting started. There's some cooler things to do at this level. Okay, so any questions?
Yeah. And my point on the last sigma that you knew the forward.
Yeah, thank you.
So why is it that it's, you can do this with math up with gravity as well?
Well, we're not doing that today, but the answer is that the splitting, the coupling to matter survives the splitting. The subtle issue is fermions, and I want to do a whole lecture on fermions, when we do spinners and fermions. Okay. But basically the fact that fermions, that Dirac fermions split into left-handed vial spinners and right-handed vial spinners, okay, is the key thing. But I want to go into that. That's worth a lot of care.
Because I think that Keplers is expressing that you think which is symmetric. It looks like exactly the opposite.
I know, but it's with the standard matter couplings, gauge fields, and fermions and scalars. Okay, and I should say spin 3/2, I should say, how this stuff, I mean, Klebanski discovered this stuff and nobody understood it. How it was rediscovered was by Amitabha Sen trying to simplify the equations of supergravity. And maybe that's also worth coming back to when we do spinners. Okay. Because the simplification here really has a lot to do, it doesn't need supersymmetry, but supersymmetry illuminates what happens and why. Okay. I love these blackboards. Okay. There's one more trick. Okay. Notice something. Okay. So just look at the feature of this S plus. Okay. S, let's just take the S plus Klebanski. Okay. And that looks like sigma plus wedge F plus. And these really have actually two indices, because there's really three of them. So if I can really, again, I can think of the 3, 0, 1, plus 2, 3 as the 1 index and so on. So I can label these indices like this. And then the cosmological term is minus 2 lambda sigma I plus wedge sigma I plus. So if I just write that, that's our old friend VF theory. We've studied that theory. That's the theory, you remember, where the equations of motion are just F is equal to, actually, the sign of the twos are in the wrong place, but roughly F is equal to lambda sigma, and D sigma plus is equal to zero. So in other words, this is like SU2VF, theory where the B2 form we said valued in SU2Lie algebra is a sigma plus. Okay. Now I've just lied. Okay. Why did I lie? Why is general relativity, which this is, not the F theory, which we show it has no degrees of freedom? Okay. Well, it could be phrased as constraint, but it's much simpler.
Yeah, just because sigma has the particular form of the wedge.
Yes, yes. So the point is that for the BF theory, which is topological, sigma plus is just, are all independent. So how many of these are there? There's each, for each I, of which there are three, there's an anti-symmetric four-dimensional, there's a two-form, which is like an anti-symmetric tensor, so that's six. So it's six times four, so this is 24 independent degrees of freedom. Okay. For general relativity, sigma plus is equal to E wedge E plus the dual. So let's take sigma plus 1 is E0 wedge E1 plus E2 wedge E3. So it's given in terms of the E's. And the E's are, there are, each of them is a one-form, so each of them has 4 degrees of freedom, and there are 4 one-forms, so there are 16 degrees of freedom. So when you vary the E's, when you vary the sigmas, you get equations like this. When you vary the E's, you get equations like E wedge F is equal to E wedge E. And here you get more equations with more extreme content. You get B is equal to sigma, and you get 24 such equations. Here you get 16 equations, which are about three forms. There are more two forms in four dimensions than there are three forms. Right? There are four three forms because it's dual. There are four one forms, six two forms, and four three forms for each eye. So roughly speaking, you get fewer equations. And therefore, there's more degrees of freedom. There's more solutions. Okay, so it's a big difference between, that's the big difference between BF theory and general relativity. Yes?
Can I reverse it? Say, if I start with BF theory, then the condition that sigma splits as such is that you have the constraints of your own.
It's coming. It's coming. Okay? And the key fact is, what are there equations that sigma satisfies such that sigma is of the form of E wedge E? And this is the next step. Flabansky did this too. This is the next step. Okay. Flabansky did this and independently it's Ted Jacobson, John Dell, Ted Jacobson, and Ricardo Cantavia did this next step. And for a long time, everybody knew what you meant when you said CDJ for Cantavia, Dell, and Jacobson. And that next step is to notice that you can, if you have three two forms, you can put conditions on them such that the solutions are that there exist four vector fields or one-form fields such that they have this relation. And those conditions, there's no way, if you've seen this before, you know, or if you haven't seen it before, I doubt that you'll guess it. Okay? But it's a remarkable fact that if you consider sigma I with it, wedge sigma j minus the third delta ij sigma k wedge sigma k equals zero, that the solution to these equations is there exists frame fields such that sigma is made from the frame fields, like this. And I should say with the plus, if there's a plus or minus in there. Okay, and I think I've lied a little bit. Wait a minute. Sorry. There are 3 times 6. There are 18 of these. Now, just to make it plausible, and I've been pausing to get it right, let's count, okay? There are 18 sigmas and 16 e's. Okay. How many such equations are there? Well, what this does is it subtracts out the trace. So this is a symmetric, trace-free tensor in 3 dimensions, because I and J run over 1, 2, and 3. So this is a symmetric trace-free tensor. We could call it sort of Sij. These are 4 forms, and there's 1 4-form per point. So there's no more. So this is 5 equations. However, given a solution to these equations, these transform under the left-handed SU2, which are 3 gauge transformations. So you get 5 equations, but 3 gauge transformations of ambiguity. Okay? And 16 is equal to 18 plus 3 minus 5, if I got it right. Okay? So, of course, that's not a proof. Okay? But just to tell you how sort of surprising this fact is, that's the counting involved in this fact. Now, the proof goes 2 ways. One way is plug this into here, and check. So that, given 4 frame fields, if you construct the sigmas like this, they satisfy this is a plug-in and check. Okay. Going the other way, getting the if and only if, the only if part, okay, is some linear algebra that I'm not going to impose on you, but you can find it in the paper of Capodiello and Jacobson. Okay, you have to invert a determinant in this by in a 5x5 space and show that all the once you have some solutions to this which are of this form, that all the solutions of this are of this form.
So the proof doesn't go by construction. Can you construct keys in terms of this?
What you can do, interestingly enough, yes, there is a constructive proof. You can construct the metric in terms of the sigmas, and I'll tell you how to do that because you'll need that if you check some of the things which are coming. If you take 3 sigmas, A, B, I, C, D, J, E, F, K, if you tie them up, epsilon, I, J, K, and you tie up 4 of the indices, D, D, E, F, you get an object which has 2 free indices, A and C. It's symmetric in them, so you get an object, let me call it H, A, C, which is a symmetric 4-dimensional tensor. Because of the epsilon, it's a density. And the construction is that H density AC is in fact equal to the square root of G GAB, where G is the B, is the metric constructed from the E field up there. And it's, you can't quite make it constructive because, see, the E, the epsilons only know about the SU2 left gauge transformations, whereas the E's know about the SU2 left and the SU2 right. So you can't get the E's from the sigmas, but you can get the G's, which are invariant under the whole Lorentz group. Okay. And this is a formula that Plobansky knew, and that later was rediscovered by Catherine Diodon Jacobson. But we're very far from that.
So the equation seems to suggest that
the
solutions are all seven.
Yes.
Seems to suggest that.
Yes, now.
So is that the theory captures of all the Einstein
domains? Yes. So notice that every solution of this is a solution of this. To say it even stronger, this equation is E wedge F minus lambda sigma is equal to zero. With one contraction there. Okay? So every solution to BF theory, which is a condition of self-duality, it's like a condition of self-duality, is a solution of the Einstein equations. And we were talking about those in the first lectures, those are the self-dual solutions. But there are other, an infinite number of other solutions to the Einstein equation which are not solutions to the BF theory.
So that's the one which captures all the gravitational Einstein constants.
Yes. Not only that, this formula is actually very useful. Supposing you have one of those solutions where sigma is equal to the self-dual part of the curvature, then this is the metric of that curvature tensor. So a fact which was not known to many people is that if you have a self-dual solution of the Einstein equations, the once densitized metric is cubic in the curvature, in the self-dual part of the curvature. So if, let me write this down, let's give this equation a name, G class. If that's true, then it follows from this that square root of G, GAB, is FI, AC, FJ, BD, FK, EF, epsilon CDEF, epsilon IJK. So that's actually very useful in studying instanton solutions. Okay. Now, we're not done. We will take a break sooner or later. Let's go one more step. Sure.
There is a notion of wild tensor being centered as opposed to Riemann.
Yes.
So that's quite different from.
They're different. Now,
is there a connection?
Sure. Because with the cosmological constant, let me see if it's the right way to say that. I think it's that with the cosmological constant zero, a solution which is Riemann self-dual, which is also a solution to the Einstein equations, is also Weyl self-dual. But not vice versa. Because if the cosmological constant is not zero, R is proportional to G, to the metric. And so there's another piece. And there is fancier ways to say that, that I will screw up if I try to remember right now. Okay. The next step, and again, this was Plibanski in the 60s and Kaplavir Dell Jacobson reconstructing it in the 80s, late 80s, was to think, well, let me invent a Lagrange multiplier to realize that constraint. So this equation, this S equation, why not realize that with a Lagrange multiplier? So I'm going to invent the Lagrange multiplier phi ij. And phi ij is going to be symmetric. So it's plus phi ji. And for the moment, let me consider the case of the cosmological constant zero, in which case it's trace free. So it's 5 degrees of freedom. And now let me consider the action, which is, and I'm going to drop the pluses everywhere, which is sigma I wedge Fi, plus now I'm going to enforce the S equation by Lagrange multiplier, and I'm going to enforce it by Phi ij times sigma I with sigma j. And because this is trace free, I don't need to write the second term. But in other words, when I vary the five, there are five things I vary and not six. And because of that, I get the trace, the part that makes it trace free subtracted out. Because I only can get an equation in the trace free part of this. So it's as if the trace free term is there. Okay, and let's stare at that for a moment. Okay. There, and notice there are 5 degrees of freedom in the phi. Okay, and anybody who notices that the self-dual part of the biotensor that was just being mentioned has in the Euclidean case 5 degrees of freedom. Would see that that may not be coincidental. And let's look at the field equations. So delta S, delta phi, gives me back these equations Sij equals zero, from which we get there exists frame fields such that sigma is E wedge E self-dual part. Okay? So we're getting back the content of general relativity, but in an implicit way. Delta S, delta sigma tells me that Fi, let me put a 1/2 here, is, and let me put a minus sign, is equal to phi ij sigma j. And finally, the last equation, delta S, delta A, which is still sitting in there, just comes here, tells me that D sigma is equal to zero. Okay? Now, if I go back by varying this, I go back to that, which is this, which is the Einstein equations. So these have to be a form of the Einstein equations. But they are a form of the Einstein equations, which are very compact and polynomial. And although I'm not going to show it now, what this is really saying is that the curvature, the SU2 left curvature, is actually given by 5 degrees of freedom, which are the biotensor. And these five is this is actually saying that there are these 5 degrees of freedom which are the left-handed part of the biotensor.
So you can actually split the biotensor into the electric and magnetic part.
Yes, and therefore you can split it into the electric plus magnetic part and electric minus magnetic part. And that's what's being done here.
It's 5 components.
And the fact that there are only 5 components in the curvature, in the left-hand part of the curvature, rather than more, if you crank a lot of cranks, this eventually you can get to your old friend RAB equals zero. Because it says that the left-handed part of the Riemann curvature tensor is actually given by only 5 degrees of freedom, whereas normally it would have 10.
But it's the vial on the ridge, so you get the constraint on the ridge.
Because there ain't nothing but the vial. Right. I'm not telling you how to do that, but you can do that. Okay? So you're getting sort of the Einstein equations backwards.
So when you say RAB, you mean Einstein?
I mean Einstein, yeah. Yeah, I mean Ritchie. Let me just write that out. And again, it's not straightforward to go from here to here, and I'll show. I don't want to show it now, but
I don't mean this.
I mean Ritchie.
What do you mean?
I mean Ritchie is equal to zero.
I see. It actually only finds the two fat matrix.
Only what?
Only the two fat matrix.
Yes, because it's the Einstein. This is implicitly the Einstein equation. And the 5 degrees of freedom of the phis, which are unconstrained, are parameterizing the solutions of the Einstein equations.
What's the significance of the equation being polynomial?
That they're easy to quantize, because they're easy to translate into operator equations. Yeah.
So, for instance, what happens is that you have matter.
But it's not a silly question, and that's also not for this lecture. But there is a way for every matter field to write it, to write the matter part of Lagrangian just in terms of the sigma, which don't, you know, you can try it at home if you like.
You mean you have some combination of sigma and matter field?
Yes. Yes. Which, when you solve everything, reduces to the Einstein equations with matter.
And what happens then to that new form of the Einstein equations?
It has other pieces given by the matter.
Okay.
It's not quite so cute anymore.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about one piece of matter which is easy. Okay. What about the cosmological constant? The cosmological constant is lambda, and there's a factor of 2 which I messed up, which comes from there being a 1/2 here, if I think so. So there's a minus lambda sigma I wedge sigma I. Okay. Well, so if I now keep it like this, then there's another term here. So there's just plus lambda times sigma I. So that's the complete equations of motion with the cosmological constant. Equivalently, one can write this as sigma I wedge Fi. One can take the lambda and put it inside the sigma in a trace. That is, I can define a psi ij, which is phi ij plus lambda delta ij. And then this is minus 1/2 just psi ij sigma I, where just sigma j. But now the condition is that the trace of psi is equal to 3 lambda. So you have a constraint on psi. And you get, anyway, these regions. Okay, can you take one more, and then we'll take a break? If you trust me up to here, okay, this, and I'll use the form with the psi, So we have a constraint that says that the trace of psi is 3 times the cosmological constant. If you trust me there, then notice that the equations say that sigma I, I'm sorry, Fi is equal to psi ij sigma j. Okay? Now, generically, the determinant of psi is going to be non-zero. So let me assume that the determinant of psi is not zero, which is true generically. And given that its trace is equal to something, you can reasonably expect that. Okay? So I can invert this and write sigma j as equal to psi inverse jk fk. And then you can write the action in the following form. I now plug this into here, and I get Fi wedge Fj times psi inverse ij. And the only constraint on that action is that the trace of psi is symmetric, psi ij is psi ji, and the trace of psi is fixed, and it's 3 times the cosmological constant. And now the action is just a function of a gauge field A, an SE2 gauge field, and 5 scalars psi, because psi has 5 scalars in it. And now that's no longer polynomial. Okay? But we've gotten rid of sigma altogether. Okay. So this is, we can keep going, we can compactify even a little bit more, but that's, so the claim is that general relativity can be expressed in terms of an action principle, in terms of an SE2 gauge field, and 5 scalar fields, which live in a symmetric matrix whose trace is fixed. Now, actually, if you stare at that, you can get it down to a function of an SE2 gauge field and 1 scalar field. But I don't have any reason to do that. Okay. But is it clear what I did in this step?
When does this fail?
Well, it may fail at some points. I mean, if it fails, then you get some degenerate, you fail to find solutions, etc. So the equivalence of this and this is only assuming that your generic point with a determinant of psi is not zero.
Do you mean
multiple
points then?
Yeah. Okay, now all of this may seem sort of abstract, but why don't we take a 15-minute break, and then when we come back, I will get you, I'm going to choose which one, probably this one, but from any one of these formulas, do you remember in the second class, I just guessed some constraint equations which I claim gave general relativity were nice and simple and polynomial in terms of an SE2 gauge field. Okay. So now, from either here or here, we're basically 2 steps away. That is, the going to the Hamiltonian form is now a few trivial steps, which we'll do after the break. Okay. questions? Okay, let's take a break. Let's come back. It's 5 after. Come back at 20 after.